Would everyone please help me welcome our speaker tonight? It's Luke M. from Solution Onshore, Neptune, New Jersey.
Hi, everybody. My name is Luke Mosley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Nice ambiance. All right, so I'm just going to start with a couple of things that I usually start with, whether I'm at a meeting, in a detox, at a psych ward, you know, a little bit to get me on autopilot and get me not thinking about me so much, because it's kind of my favorite thing to do. It's kind of what I'm best at. And the hope is that by the time I'm done rambling, God takes over somewhere between the 1 minute and 5 minute mark. And you guys hear something useful tonight. If not, at least you help me guarantee my sobriety for the evening. So thank you for that in advance. I've got a home group, Solution on the Shore, like you heard. It meets at 8 o'clock p.m. in Neptune, New Jersey on Saturday nights. We also have a second meeting now. What started as a little young people's big book meeting on Friday nights at 10 p.m. has grown into, you know, our step meeting. It's really cool. In the 3.5 years that I've been sober, I've seen the group kind of grow. We went from a smaller meeting in the clubhouse in the area to moving to a church, you know, with 120 seats in the basement and filling the place almost every Saturday night. You know, there's something going on there similar to what's going on here. It's what people call a pocket of enthusiasm. I don't know what that means, because it's the only thing I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that we work out of the big book. I know that we're all about helping people, and we're all about sponsorship and, you know, taking some simple direction. And that hasn't failed me since November 10, 2010. And for that, I'm truly blessed, and most days not grateful enough. You know, but I try to keep it simple. I try to stick to what my sponsor tells me to do, and things just keep getting better. And that wasn't always the case. You know, I was born in, grew up in the mean woods of Jackson, New Jersey. Probably wouldn't be too intimidating to anybody out here. This kind of feels like home when I get out in Pennsylvania. But it's a little section of Jackson that has not developed, has not grown up. There's a lot of woods, and that's where I played. That's where I hung out. I've got a twin sister who's 7 minutes younger than me, so I've had built-in friends my entire life. Kind of resentful of her, though. I only got the spotlight for about 7 minutes before she showed up and started making me compete for my parents' affection. And I've got two younger sisters after that, another set of twins. They're 18 months behind us, so there's four of us all close in age. And then my younger sister, the baby, she's about 3 or 4 years younger than the rest of us. You know, so five kids close in age. No wonder my mom drinks, right? Chasing around four kids in diapers, and you know, I was the ringleader. And I can remember, even at that early age, you know, just feeling separate from my family. I had the suspicion that my mom and dad somehow loved my sister differently than they loved me. I know today that was the truth. You know, a mother loves her daughters different than she loves her son. A father loves his daughters different than he loves his son. Just so happened I was the only son. I was also a pain in the ass, so that probably slowed him down a little bit too. You know, but I remember feeling that something's not right from an early age. And the thing I remember most vividly is always looking for the reason why, trying to identify that reason why I felt disconnected. 4 or 5 years old, you know, if I couldn't make my mom and dad pay attention for the positive stuff I was doing, I was acting out, I was doing negative things. I learned in a house that noisy, being loud is the best way to get all the attention. So I developed my loud voice. I learned how to get my parents to look. You know, so that being said, the quiet part of the house is usually where the trouble was, and that would serve me well later in life, listening for the quiet spots in the house if I wanted to get into trouble. You know, but, you know, fast forward, those underlying feelings, those low-lying feelings of being disconnected and being a little bit apart from, they just grow, they intensify as I get a little bit older. I remember going to school for the first time, getting on the school bus, anybody here ever see Forrest Gump? He gets on the school bus and can't sit here, so he's taken. Well, I get on the school bus with my twin sister, right? She's been my friend since 7 minutes after I got started, so I figured we got something here. We'll just stick together. I'll be fine on the bus ride to school. We get halfway down the bus, and she gets into a two-seater with this girl that I've never met before. No, she's betrayed my trust now. She's betrayed my loyalty as a brother, and I'm reeling. Like, what am I going to do now? I got to sit with somebody else. And I made the decision about 5 steps past that seat that if I get to this back door on this bus and I haven't found a seat, I'm just going out the back. You know, I'll jump off the bus, I'll run into the woods, I'll start over again somewhere else. It'll be a lot less pressure than sit with a stranger. And that's my alcoholic mind at 5 or 6 years old. it gets better from there, I promise. You know, so that's my first best friend is a kid that let me sit with him on a school bus the first day of kindergarten. Joe McGinley, I remember to this day. He's got a wife now. He's got a couple of kids. He's like a fairly well-adjusted dude. Drinks at special events and not like a maniac. It's weird. I don't get it. You know, that was my first best friend, and I hung on to him until middle school, almost high school, because he let me sit with him on a school bus, and that's kind of how my loyalties run. If you get me out of a bad situation, if you let me run around with you, you got me for life, for good or for bad. I'm right there by your side until you do something bad enough that chases me away. So fast forward a little bit, I turned into like the nurse's office kid. You know, I don't know if anybody knows that kid, but you know, I had these mysterious illnesses that nobody could quite identify. I gave them elaborate names like broken arm and broken leg. Never successfully faked a broken arm or a broken leg, but I tried a bunch of times. If the nurse sent me back to class, I'd do something, get sent to the principal's office. But my favorite place to be during the school day was the guidance counselor's office. You know, that well-intentioned man or woman would ask me, what's going on? How are you feeling? What's wrong? You know, if you got an hour and a half to talk about it, we could try to make some progress on this. And like the big book says, I'll make up a number of reasons. I'll give you a number of explanations as to why I feel this way today. But deep down, I don't know. You know, I'm just awful and I can't explain it. Now, at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, I don't have the vocabulary to explain that I'm irritable. I don't have the vocabulary to explain that I'm anxious. I just know that I feel off. You know, and I start looking for ways to make that feel better. And again, one of the earliest ways I felt better was by getting attention. Sympathy is probably the best one that does it for me. If I don't have drugs and alcohol, if you feel bad for me, that's love right there. That's you care if you feel bad for me in that moment. And I rehearsed every sad story, every bad thing that ever happened to me. I filed it away, and I perfected the way I told it. And the longer you would listen, the sadder you would be, and the better I felt. And 11, 12, 13 years old, like I'm this maniac talking about every bad thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm already starting to see that, like, I've gotten dealt a bad hand here. You know, I don't know what happened in a previous life for me to deserve what I got, but things are tough for Luke Mosley. You know, it's me against the world, and I'm running around on self-will at an early age, trying to figure out why all this negativity is coming at me all the time. You know, a slave to my feelings, a slave to depression at 12, 13 years old. Somewhere around there was my first suicide attempt. It was more of a gesture than an attempt. My parents were pissed about that. I remember coming home. My dad beat the crap out of me for that one. He's like, what the hell are you doing? I don't know. You know, got me attention at school. I was the first and last kid ever to go through the school district who couldn't leave the classroom after that by myself. Have a security guard come with me to walk me to the bathroom. I had a security guard with me when I changed classes. And I was on this list. It was a very short, very prestigious list. You know, very elite group of kids that needed to be supervised at all times. And like, even in the middle school and high school, they were afraid to give me real scissors. So needless to say, I got really comfortable in places like psych wards. Before I ever started showing up in detoxes and rehabs, like I made my way through a couple of psych wards. My best run ever, I did about 2 months at an inpatient adolescent program. That was 7th grade. I didn't want to leave there. You know, I got there and I felt really comfortable. It felt like if I could just stay here forever, like maybe I got a fighting chance. At that point in my life, people were still looking at me from the outside, and I did a convincing job of looking like I had it all together, believe it or not, even the psych ward. I was the responsible kid in the psych ward. I was the responsible kid running around with my group of misfit friends. And at 13 years old, people were like, kids' parents were saying, why can't you be more like Luke? You know, why can't you be mature like that? He's so mature for his age. 13 years old is the last time anybody ever said anything like that about me. I stopped being mature from my age at 13 and a half, and I've been playing catch up ever since. You know, but that's when everything kind of came to a head. That's when the emotions, that's when the feelings really started to get at me in a way that I couldn't deal with it anymore. I started acting out, looking for something. And the first thing I found, other than, you know, suicide attempts, because that doesn't have much of a shelf life, unless you're good at it, then it's done forever, right? So I was the other one. I wasn't very good at it, thank God. But I found church. I don't know how I found it. My parents took us to Sunday school when we were kids. My parents are not religious people by any stretch of the imagination. They both have their own patent brand of spirituality. My dad believes in the Force from Star Wars. My mom believes in leaving the doors and windows open for the cats and the dogs and whatever stray animals you find, bring them home, bring in homeless people. Kind of the golden rule, like be good to people. You know, just be nice. Don't fight with your sisters. Those are my mom's rules for living. But from that, it's funny, I look back today, I had a couple of years in the Methodist church. I had a lifetime of listening to my mom and my dad, and today the patent brand of spirituality that feels right for me is a mix of the Bible, the Force from Star Wars, and be nice to your friends and your neighbors. So I guess it had an impact somewhere along the line. But church was not something that pushed on us. I gravitated to the church because there was grown-ups there. I could listen to what the grown-ups were saying. I could repeat that back in conversation later to other grown-ups, and they'd pat me on the head and tell me how grown-up I sounded for my age, how mature I was. And it was like the perfect forum for a maniac of a little kid like me, right? I would go there on Sundays. I was the youth something or other. I don't know. They gave me all kinds of fancy titles. I like fancy titles. To this day, you can pay me $5 less an hour if you give me a title. It doesn't make sense, but my ego likes it. But I was holding positions in the youth conference at the United Methodist Church, and I felt like this is it. This is going to be the thing that makes me feel okay. This is the thing that I can get to be a part of, because up until then, anything I'd ever tried to do had a shelf life. You know, I'd go and I'd get involved in a team, or I'd go and get involved in a club at a school, and eventually the kids there would get to know me a little too well. And my fear is that you're going to find me out for the fraud, because I do this social communion thing. I go to you, and whatever your favorite color is, that's my favorite color. Whatever your favorite sports team is, that's my favorite sports team. Your favorite band is my favorite band. The other half of the time, I'm terrified you're going to ask me about a player on the team that's not Michael Jordan. Or you're going to ask me about a song on the album that's not on the radio. You know, and I've got that facade put up. Any moment it's going to come crashing down, so I move to the next group of friends and the next activity. And church was away from my school, it was away from my friends, it was away from, my family wasn't going there, you know, it was just me. My pastor was picking me up on Sunday mornings, and for a little while everything felt good there. I parroted back what my pastor said. I didn't quite understand this God thing they were talking about, but I knew it seemed real to them, you know, it seemed really real, whatever this God thing was they were talking about. So I talked like they talked, and I thought that eventually I'd feel how they felt. And I'll never forget, we went on a retreat to this place in South Jersey. It's called Mount Misery. It's as beautiful as it sounds. Lots of mosquitoes, pine forest, sand and everything, and not a beach like for miles and miles and miles. And we're down at Mount Misery, and I remember at the end of the night they had, like, I don't know what it was really called, but to me it was like a pep rally for Jesus. And they were singing songs, and there was food, and there was all kinds of like high energy stuff going on. And they were telling everybody who wanted to be saved to come down to the front of the stage. If you want to be saved, come down to the front. And I look at my pastor, because I don't know what this saved is. Bill, what's saved? And it was the first time somebody had kind of taken their finger and poked it in that open wound in my chest and gave a name and a solution to my problem. This underlying thing that I was just kind of half aware of, kind of thought maybe I remember, but would never paid it too much mind. Somebody identified that thing in me. You know, at the same time, it gave me a little bit of hope, and in the same breath, that hope was kind of, it vanished right in front of me. Because he said to me, "Luke, you know that piece of you, that part of you that just doesn't feel complete, it always feels like there's got to be something more for you." I was like, "Yeah, man, I know that part. What is that?" He says, that's the part of your heart you haven't given to Jesus Christ. And once he has Jesus Christ into your heart, you're going to know, like we talk about, the promises. You're going to know peace. You're going to know serenity. Everything's just going to feel a little bit closer to right. You're going to be okay. And I was just like, sign me up. Like, if that's all I, you know, that's all that's wrong with me, I haven't been saved yet, like, let's go get saved. Let's do this. I go down to the front of the stage, I put my hands up, I say this prayer, I turn around like everybody else is doing. And I realize these people around me, they're having this, what looks like a profound experience, right? And all I'm doing is faking. And like at that moment, it was like one of those defining moments in my life where I felt so far away from everybody else in the room that it was just like, oh man, like, is this really it? The best we got to feeling okay is running around talking about something we don't quite believe in. hoping nobody's going to call us on it. You know, if that's what this is, if this is as close as I'm going to get to okay, like, then I'm done. I'll go hard the other direction. And at 12, 13 years old, you know, I made a bold conclusion that God is not real. You know, you all do a great job talking about God. You all do a convincing job of sounding passionate about this thing, but you're all frauds. Or B, this God thing is real, and worse off, doesn't want anything to do with my well-being. Doesn't want Luke to be okay. You know, I had some suspicions about some things that had happened earlier in my life, some abuse that I was somehow damaged with, you know, that I was beyond being loved. There was somehow some kind of mark on me that maybe separated me from God, caused me judgment. I know today that's got nothing to do with anything. You know, it's another sad story that I ran around with and I told for a long time because it put me in the seats that I wanted to be in, talking to people that I wanted to talk to about my favorite subject, which is me, and how bad I'm doing, what I need to be okay, and what I expect from other people, and how you need to show up to make my life just a little bit more bearable, you know, a day at a time. You know, but I about faced from there, I head the other direction, I'm disenfranchised, I'm ticked off. You know, how could these people lie to me? How could they all run around like such frauds? And I did the best I could for the next couple of years. Anybody talked about God, anybody talked about church, you know, real condescending, like, oh, yeah, you're God, huh? The God thing, right, that's great. You know, and then I calmed down a little bit by about 16, 17 years old, and I just kept my mouth shut. And I had that smug superiority, like, oh, he's talking about God. That's nice if that works for him. You know, and secretly thinking one day you're going to find out what I know, that this God thing, it's a sham. You know, and put myself further and further on the outside. So that was a spiritual disconnect. I don't know if a lot of people could trace back that moment to like one spot in time, one moment, but you know, some of my favorite AAs talk about seconds and inches, and that's one of those spots that at a defining moment in my life, something happened, and I went the other way, and things are different because of that. Not too long after that, I found a much easier solution to my problem, alcohol. I found alcohol kind of by accident, one of those quiet points in the house. It was a Friday night. My sisters had some friends over. I had some friends over, and there was a quiet corner of the house, my little sister's bedroom. So I go down there, I open the door, and they've got a cheap bottle of tequila. I look at them, they're 18 months younger than I am, and way too young to be drinking, so I take the bottle, I'm going to show them how it's done. Mind you, I've taken sips off Dad's beer before, a couple of sips off a glass off the table, and you know, never really felt an effect, never felt a draw to drink more. But I noticed that when my parents drank, when their friends were around, they drank, they had a good time. I kind of put two and two together. It's what grown-ups do when they want to have fun. But this was the first time I really felt the effect created by alcohol. I remember taking that bottle and remember throwing it back and it burned and it was nasty, so I stopped. So I brought it up to the kitchen. I found some iced tea powder. I made a funnel out of a paper towel. I'm a smart kid, very smart, lots of good ideas. I make this funnel, and I put the iced tea powder in the bottle and shake it up, and I start to drink it warm. It still tastes nasty, but it's a little bit sweet, and I can get it down. And all of a sudden, this crazy thing happens. You know, I feel this warmth in my chest. You know, all of a sudden, it's just... And I get that first big, deep breath of my entire life, where everything just feels a little bit more quiet, a little bit more calm, like there's a potential for everything to be okay for maybe just a little while. Because this world is too close to me, right? That's too in my face, it's too loud, it's too much pressure, there's too much disappointment, there's too much worry, there's too much anger, there's just too much going on, and it's too close, I'm claustrophobic, uncomfortable in my own skin. All of a sudden, everybody just takes one giant step away from Luke, and I can breathe, and I feel like I got a little bit of room to operate. And I've heard people talk about drinking alcohol and feeling they can run faster and jump higher and they're more articulate. I didn't think any of those things. I just cared less what you thought about me anymore. I couldn't care. I couldn't care anymore. You put a couple of drinks in me and I don't care so much what you're thinking on the other side of the room. You know, I have a couple of more and I can walk around with ease and I can say the things that are going on in my head most of the time. I make those comments out loud. They're always in my head anyway, but you're laughing now. And now we're friends. And a couple hours later, we're all friends. And I feel connected. I'm in the middle of this thing. First time, 12, 13 years old, all the way to college, the last time it was fun when I picked up a drink. That same effect is what I was going for every single time. The only problem is it's elusive, man. It runs from me every single time, and I overshoot the mark. If you're anything like me, you suffer from a physical allergy. You know, I'm a real alcoholic. I'm not here to convince anybody tonight they're alcoholic. I hope I do a good job of convincing you that I am, and that I got a solution that's worked for me for the past 3.5 years. And what that looks like out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we don't define alcoholism, we just describe our first step, is that once I start, I don't know when I'm going to stop, and once I stop, I don't know when I'm going to start again, and the whole time between the last one and the next one is still this obsession, this insanity that I just got to get the next one to be okay. You know, and you can line up consequences, you can line up people I care about, you can line up strangers, you can put a brick wall in front of me, but I'm getting through that brick wall, I'm getting through grandma, I'm getting through mom and dad's bank account, I'm getting whatever I need to get the next one. You know, the cumulative effect of living like that for a few years is like my soul just starts to get real dim. You know, I believe that I've always had an inner voice or an inner something, something in my gut. I don't know where your God lives. Some people have it in their head and their heart. Like, mine's right in my gut. My head tells me lies that are based on my delusions and my emotions and my heart. I make fear-based decisions with my heart, but my gut has never steered me in the wrong direction, even on those worst days. You know, when things were really, really bad, there was always something in my gut that said, don't do that. Doesn't mean I always listen. But it never told, you know, it never sent me in the wrong direction. You know, God has always been in my gut, but the problem was I turned that voice so far down, that conscience, that contact, that connection, whatever it was so quiet that I couldn't even hear it anymore. You know, the cumulative effect of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has been turning the volume back up on that little voice and turn the volume down on everything else that goes on in my head on a daily basis. It's been through simple actions that I've been able to do that, but you know, I didn't know any of that. Picking up a drink for the first time, I didn't know what life was going to look like for the next 10 years. From that first night, I black out, right? I take the bottle, I start drinking like a maniac. My sisters tell me later because I blacked out. It wasn't one of those half-hearted things. Like, I went for it until I didn't remember anything until I woke up the next morning. I woke up in the shower, at the bottom of the bathtub, shower running cold on me. Face is split open. My head is throbbing. And there's puke in the drain. And my first thought was, how did I get here? My second thought was, when am I doing this again? You know, my sister said, I started to drink that bottle. I was up on the bunk beds. I jumped off, landed on my face, started to bleed everywhere. They screamed, I laughed, I did it again. You know, lather, rinse, repeat for the next 10 or 15 years. I am drinking for the effect. I am drinking for the show. I'm drinking to impress you. I'm drinking to outdrink the next guy. Like, whatever it is, I want more. You know, and apply that to other substances. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I appreciate our singleness of purpose. I really do. If it wasn't for our singleness of purpose, I probably wouldn't have stuck around. I never would have identified and realized what I really suffered from, which is a spiritual malady. No, it's the spiritual malady, the second part of what the big book talks about, that really gets me every time. You know, the mental obsession is the thing I've got no power over, you know, but the spiritual malady is the thing that really causes the unmanageability in my life. a maniac. You know, 12, 13 years old. And I start to chase other substances. I start to use them as I get into college. I'm not going to insult your intelligence. It wasn't powdered alcohol. I wasn't getting my bartender on the corner. I was going into neighborhoods that I had no business being in because alcohol stopped doing what I wanted it to do. I don't know if it matters to anybody else in this room, but there's a really distinct reason why I drank, and there was a really distinct reason why I did drugs. I drank alcohol because it made me feel like I was a part of it. It helped me to connect for a little while. Those walls between you and me, that disconnect, whatever that noise was that was there, got cleared out, and all of a sudden we're best friends, we're right there, and everything's good. And when that didn't work anymore, the only alternative for me, if I can't be a part of the party, I got to be alone in the basement by myself with the lights off and not caring about what I've done to the people in my life, the people that care about me. I can't look at my actions. I need oblivion. I need to be numb. You know, and hard drugs did that for me, a combination of sedatives and morphine, you know, so to speak. I was shooting speedballs. I was taking anything I could get my hands on, but whatever got me out of me, whatever made me go up and down at the same time and helped me to be numb, that's the feeling I was looking for. Just turned me off. And I chased after the gates a couple of times. I've been revived 2 or 3 times. I don't remember because I was dead for a couple of minutes. You know, but like the broken tooth in the front of my face, that was a New Year's Eve. That was a good time for nobody but me. Story of my life. Once I show up, my friends stopped inviting me to parties because I'd show up and I'm the only one having a good time. Still the case that you. But I mean, on New Year's Eve, I remember it was like I'm just gonna control it tonight. And at that point in my life, I guess I'm 21 years old. I guess it was my 21st New Year's Eve. I was gonna control it tonight. So I had the right combination of this and that. I'm gonna start with alcohol. A bottle of Goldschlager was what I thought to be a responsible start to the year. You know, let's just stay with shots or sparkly. That's awesome. Festive. Drinking the Goldschlager. And then progressing to other things, and that phenomenon of craving takes over. The more I have, the more I want. And I get to be ugly. Like, stand between me and my car and try to take my keys away from me, and like, I turn into a maniac. I've heard horror stories from my friends of them being in the passenger seat, hanging on for dear life as I'm just maniac and driving around, swerving in and out of lanes. And, you know, like, I thought that was fun. I thought that was a good time. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd be overly remorseful. So the more my drinking got out of control, the more I moved to the hard drugs. And the more I moved into the hard drugs, the worse my behavior, you know, the darker my soul got, the more I was willing to do to get the next one. But I really think I could have gotten here with the alcohol alone. Without the drugs, it just would have been a slower process. To become physically addicted to alcohol, that takes some dedication. I've had some shaky mornings, you know. I've had some bad hangovers, but to chase alcohol to physical addiction, that, you know, I gotta respect anybody who's done it. I don't know how you got there, because before I get there, I wake up and my head hurts so bad, or I feel like I'm falling apart at the seams so bad that I'm moving on to things that don't make me feel so bad late into the day. But the worst consequence of my drinking was that coming to out of a blackout, walking around in the middle of a party and realizing, in the middle of a party, I'm crying right now. And not only am I crying, I'm sobbing, like the kind where snot's coming out of your face and people are trying to console you. And I come out of these blackouts like full Slimer mode. And I'd be like, oh my God, I did it again. Like, what am I even crying about? You know? And I'd wake up the next morning and be like, dude, we got to tell you about what you did last night. I'm like, I really wish you would have. You know, let's just forget that ever happened. And they'd be like, all right, just don't do it again. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You know, this is probably about the point people will start saying things like, ooh, maybe you have a problem. Maybe you're drinking too much. And so what are you talking about? It's ridiculous. The hard drugs, like I could definitely tell you that the hard drugs were, you know, not the best way to control my feelings and my emotions. But alcohol, I just drink like a normal person. I'm just here to have a good time. I'm here to party. You know, where are you guys going? I grabbed the butcher's knife one night and I was swinging at my friends, and you know, I thought that was normal because he had swung one at me a couple of weeks before that, and everybody else was just overreacting. Didn't last too long at college, it's weird. Ended up back at my parents' house, like every grown man, things go bad back at mom and dad's house. I'm gonna move back in. They said no, they ain't locked the doors, so I took that as a welcome invitation. I get back there, and so starts the cycle of the next 10 years, which is just build it up, pull it down, build it up, pull it down, build it up, pull it down. Family is hopeful, fingers crossed. This time it's going to be different for him. He seems to really want to be a grown-up. And then I pull the thing back down on my head. The only difference from the first round to the last round is how fast that cycle goes. The first time was 3 years. You know, then it was 2 years. And I remember after that 2-year run of like holding it all together, having the job, having the stuff, having a nice apartment, having a nice car, having things, you know, the things that were going to make me feel okay, like I had gotten that list of things that I needed to accomplish and the team was getting shorter. And I ended up in a detox again. You know, it was the second or third time I've been into a detox. And it was one of those, another one of those points, seconds and inches, right? And it's so funny. It was an Easter Sunday that my grandma and grandpa came to pick me up from the detox because mom and dad had gone away to my mom's family's down in Delaware. And my grandma and grandpa had volunteered to pick me up, and I get in the car and I give them the old, you know what, this time I know what I need to know. I've learned enough about addiction and about drugs and alcohol, and I know my family history, and this time I just got to make better decisions. You know, I was beating that rehab drum. If you're a guy like me, that rehab drum doesn't work. It's not about decision making. I make lots of decisions with ease. They're just always the wrong ones, and I don't know it until it's too late. They pick me up, and my grandma says, "Why don't you just stay with us, you know, for the night until your parents get home?" And I was like, "No, I don't pick up my car. I got things to do. I'm very busy. It's Easter Sunday afternoon. Nothing's open. I can't can't accomplish anything, but I'm propelled to get out of there. I got to get my car. And I've been able to maintain a driver's license, car insurance, all these things up until a couple of months before this last bout in detoxing and rehab. The insurance lapsed on the car, registration got pulled, and I get right in that car and they drop me off with my to-do list from rehab, things that I must accomplish to be a responsible person again. You know, and number one is like get insurance back in my car. Number two is register. Number three is fill my meds. I move that to the top, move the other two down, go to fill the meds, and I get rear-ended by the wife of a cop in the town that he was a cop in. I've got no registration, no insurance. I've got a detox wristband on my wrist. You know, I was going to wear that for a couple of days. It'd be a great sad story to tell people. And I felt stupid about it when the cop pulled up. I was just like, oh, no. You know, so I lost my car through a series of unfortunate events and bad timing, right? And no fault of my own, I lose my car and my license. And that slowed me down, you know? So from there on out, it was just a quick shot to the bottom. I circled the drain for about 7 more years. And I do the same things over and over again. I steal from my parents, I take money, I think they're caring, they're concerned, and I make people worry constantly. Die a couple of times, and this last time was no different. Except for I was engaged to a woman. I had been living with her for 2 years. I was holding her hostage. We'd get in fights every once in a while when I was, you know, aggravated enough, sober enough to engage. She'd say something like, Luke, is there anything you want to tell me? And I'd say, Suzanne, is there anything you want to ask me? And she would walk away, usually pretty backed down by that. But I mean, it wasn't working. I told her that I got denied unemployment. And then she took my mailbox key, so I popped open the mailbox, got my unemployment check that I claimed I wasn't getting, that I was denied for, and she was like, is there anything you want to tell me about the mailbox? Is there anything you want to ask me about the mailbox? No. No. And I'd stay on the couch all day, and I'd do what I needed to do to stay out of me and not feel bad about the things that I was doing to the people around me. And one day it was a little bit different. She said, is there anything you want to tell me? And I said, is there anything you want to ask me? And she said, yeah. And what she had found, a secret email account that I had held for a couple of years. I didn't tell her that I was gay because it was really none of her business. I figured by the time we were married with kids, it wouldn't really matter anyway. But she'd all bet that she when she found out, right? She was like, are you gay? I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, you got the secret email account. I put a password thing on the computer. What are you doing? I was like, oh, it's because I'm getting drunk. I'm getting high. That's the only reason. She was like, yeah, no, you got to get out. And I was like, I thought you loved me. We can work through this. You know, very close-minded woman. She kicked me out. So I called my parents, right? Because it's what I do when things go bad. I call mom and dad again. And I say, Mom, Dad, I got to come home. And my mom says, what did you do to that girl? And I said, nothing, Mom. It's just bad timing. It's bad luck. It's no fault of my own. You know, she's unreasonable. You know, now it's her fault. It's her fault that I drank. And deep down in my mind, like, I'm always looking for reasons. People have started asking me long before this, like, Luke, what is wrong with you? I'm like, I don't know. Let's try this on for size. You know, and this is my latest try on for size. The latest thing, it's like the one thing I haven't looked at. It's got to be because I'm gay, living in the closet, and dishonestly engaged to a woman for the last 2 years, right? Like, that's something I can sink my teeth into. That makes anybody nuts. Like, this has got to be why I can't put this stuff down. Because I made decisions, right? And I thought that I had changed my mind. Decided to stop drinking and doing drugs. I've changed my mind. I'm going to start again. If I take a sober look at that today, it's not what happened at all. I made a decision to stop. I was powerless over the first one. Took the first one, and then my mind changed, right? Triggers that phenomenon I'm craving. Triggers that mental obsession, and I'm off to the races again. I never saw it coming because I got nothing between me and the first one. And I learned that going through the big book with a sponsor and having it pointed out to me in my own experience. But she kicks me out. I go back to mom and dad's house, and I run through the last couple of things on her list of why am I so screwed up? Why am I so damaged? You know, and they all just kind of fall short. And I make a decision. I'm going to ride it out to the end. You know, I'm just going to go hard, and I'm going to be as numb as possible until dead happens or whatever happens, wherever I end up, I end up. And, you know, it got ugly in the last couple of months. I stole my parents. I drained their bank account a couple of times over the course of a couple of years. And this last time, they did the same thing. It wasn't any more money than ever been before, like $1,500. They were trying to get the mortgage money together for the end of the month. My parents don't have savings. They got five kids. And They had mortgage money and bill money in the bank, and I took that without thinking twice about it. Saddest part of that whole thing is the PIN number on my mom's ATM card is the same as it was the first two times I drained the bank account. You know, mom and dad never stopped loving me to the point where he's not capable of it. You know, he can't do this again. He means it this time. Just trashing them over and over again, running them through it. You know, this time is no different. I took their money. I took their peace of mind. And I remember walking up. They got a long dirt driveway back in the woods. And I remember walking up the driveway, and my dad's at the gate. And usually it was a fight, right? Oh, what the hell is wrong with you? Why don't you just stop? Rah, 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 noise, noise. And I yell back, because when somebody yells at me, I yell louder. It's just what I'm programmed to do. But I walked up the driveway, and I see my dad at the back gate, and just shaking his head. You know, and it was like at that moment, another one of those moments, seconds and inches, I felt so far away from everybody. And my own father, like, I see him looking through me right now. He doesn't get it. He's just like all those other people for the last couple of years. Why don't you just stop? If you knew what I felt like without it, you wouldn't even ask me to stop. You know, drugs are not my problem. Alcohol is not my problem. My problem is sobriety. My problem is the way my brain attacks me every time I get a sober couple of breaths in me. You know, I'm just feeling so far away because I knew he didn't understand. He looked at me and said, Luke, why don't you stop? You know, but for the first time ever, I answered honestly. I'd say, Dad, I don't know. I walked past my dad that day, and they told me, you're going to jail. We called the cops on the way, and I do a grown-ass man. Do I cry? I said, don't call the cops. Please, let me stay. And they said, you got 24 hours to get into a detox again. You know, I have a long list of places I could call, places I could go, the ones I like the most, the ones with the best meds. And I took the one that was going to take me the fastest. You know, so I end up October 21st, 2010, back in the detox. And I walk in the doors, and I'm just baffled. How did this happen again? It was supposed to be different. I was supposed to manage better. And I'm in this detox, and, you know, for the first time, I start to realize, like, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't think I want to do this anymore. This stopped being fun years ago. This feels too much like work. You know, I had a little bit of a willingness to maybe live differently. I didn't know that I wanted to stop for good. I knew I didn't want the consequences ever again, and they told me that one had something to do with the other, so I was willing to hear them out for a little while. You know, and in that detox, members of Alcoholics Anonymous came in. They brought in commitments, and they talked about the powerlessness. They talked about the unmanageability. They talked about the first step and described the first step experience and never defined it or told me I was or wasn't an alcoholic. They did everything we asked a good AA to do, you know, but it didn't really click. No, I still had that victim mentality. It was still bad circumstances. Got to account for a lot of this, right? Bad time and bad luck and bad hand. You know, and I wrote that out through the detox. I felt like maybe I identified more in other fellowships than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't read the big book, but you were talking about alcohol being a problem, and it wasn't a problem for me. I drank a normal person, right? So I thought, you know, but I go through the detox. I go through the rehab. And what I had was some time away to flop around and feel better and look at consequences and learn some tools for productive living and positive decision making that are really helpful if you're not a guy that's wired like I am. But if you're a guy that's wired like I am, you're going to need something a little bit bigger. In order to find something bigger, you got to know what powerlessness is. I didn't know it yet. So I get out of rehab. I get out of detox rehab. 28-day stint. And I had nowhere to go, so they had set me up with the halfway house that they ran, and I was going to go up the hill to the halfway house. And if you hooked me up to a lie detector that morning, I said, Luke, do you want to drink? Do you want to do drugs anymore? And I said, no, I'm done with it. You know, I don't like the pain it causes. I don't like the consequences. Got a little bit of time now. Let's just go with this thing, see how it goes. I'm committed to it. You know, 2 hours later, I relapsed. I picked up. You know, because I get to the halfway house, and they say, welcome to the halfway house, a place you've never been before, 17 people you've never met. Go be sober. And I'm just like, oh, I don't know how to do it. And I freak out. I'm uncomfortable. You know, it's like showing up for Pop Warner tryouts back in middle school, right? I know today that it wasn't tryouts. It was signups. You showed up. You paid you $20, and they let you on the team. And walking up to the table, get hit with that panic of, like, we got to get out of here. Turn around, grab my mom. Like, Mom, we got to go. We got to get out of here. Her looking at me like I'm a crazy person. I got crazy person going through my head as I'm walking in this halfway house. And they say to me, do you want to stay here and settle in? And I was like, what are my other options? And so we can take you out to find a job. And I said, okay. taking me out to find a job, and without a dollar in my pocket, without a cell phone, without a plan, and without any kind of defense, I go back out into the world, right? Completely untreated, completely insane. And I do what makes sense for a guy like me. I pick up the first thing I can pick up to get me out of me. I get back to the halfway house that night, and I keep my eyes down, and let me go to bed early because I'm new, and I'm just coming off of detox meds, and that must be it, give them a pass. And I wake up the next morning in one of the nicest, safest, warmest, cleanest places I've been in months, if not years. You know, I'm laying in this bed knowing that I've got food. I've got people taking care of me. They're telling the cops not to come for me. They're writing letters already. I've been there a few hours and they're doing what they can for me. And I'm terrified. Because I don't know what the heck just happened last night. Because for the first time in my life, I wanted to stop and I can't do it on my own. You know, and that's when I experience the powerlessness. And the first step talks about the unmanageability. I've got a drawer for that. It's the mail that comes that says final notice. It says, you know, it comes from a court. You know, they're coming for me. They want my money. They want my freedom. They want something from me. And I put it in this drawer and I close it real fast. And I look in there. And once a month, I empty it out. And I throw that stuff away. And I feel like I've done a lot for my life. Clearing out the wreckage of my past. You know, one drawer at a time. You know, I wake up and I'm terrified because I know I've got one place to go back to, and that's the people I was around with before I went to detox and before I went to mom and dad's this last time, and I'm scared. You know, so I go, I call a family member and I cry. I call my Aunt Sue and I tell her, Aunt Sue, I don't know what it is, but everything was great when I was between these four walls. I was in this rehab, things were comfortable, people liked me. It's probably delusional thinking, but everything felt okay. And I leave these four walls, and all of a sudden, new things start to happen, and my brain just attacks me. You know, it feels like my brain's telling me I'm dying. You know, and she gets off the phone, and she says, Luke, I don't know what to tell you. Things seem so good again. I've built up their hope, and I'm taking it away. I haven't told her that I got high. You know, I can't admit to that, that I've started drinking again less than 4 hours out of the rehab. You know, but I tell her about my feelings and how I'm a victim. I can get that message across no matter what's going on in the front of things. But she calls me back a little bit later, and she says, we got a phone number for you. What happened between getting off the phone and calling me back? And she broke down in the office. A coworker came over to comfort her, and she said, Sue, what's wrong? And she said, you know my nephew, Luke? And she said, yeah, the junkie. And she said, yeah, that's the one. Yeah. The one with all the potential, right? The P word. I said, I don't know. He just sounded different this time. He seems broken. He seems hopeless, and I don't know what to do for him. You know. That woman said, I'm going to give you a phone number. It's the phone number of my son. He's former sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't a junkie. He was just an alcoholic. And I don't know if he can help you next, but I know he'll try. You know, because he's been doing something the last 4 months and it's really changed his life. I barely even recognize him. My aunt calls me back. She gives me this phone number. And by an act of God, I call this guy. I humble myself. And he says, how you doing? At first I say, fine, great, good, making positive decisions. Made a list of relapse triggers. You know, I've got priorities in my life. I've got a plan to get a part-time job. And he says, how are you doing? And I said, I don't know. I'm losing my mind. I don't know what to do. And he said, that's okay. So he picks me up that night, and he picks me up almost every night for the next 90 days, and he gets me out to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gets me plugged into the group that I'm a part of today. I mean, I still show up there every Saturday. It's like the most important thing for me to be at. I've got this priority system in my life, and I know it's going to sound out of whack for a lot of you, and that's okay. It's just what works for me, and it's kept me sober 3.5 years. It goes God and AA, my family and friends, and everything else, in that order. Sometimes they shuffle for a day or an afternoon, but God and AA stay first. You know, that doesn't mean I don't show up for my mother's birthday. That doesn't mean that I don't show up for my family. I show up for the important stuff in life, but if I'm just hanging out and I got nothing better to do, no excuse, nobody's died, nobody's getting married, I don't want my home group on a Saturday night. You know, it's important to me to be there. It's where I got plugged in. It's where I go to fly my flag in Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about my crazy opinions and ideas. And I meet these guys in detoxes and rehabs, and I tell them where to find me, and every once in a while they show up and they meet me there. Instead of me having to meet them where they're at, sometimes they come and they see me. And once in a while you get a guy like my buddy Pat drove me up here tonight. I've been sponsoring Pat for a couple of years, and he's come to be one of my closest friends. Went to the same halfway house I did, and I remember going in the first night, and I asked him, how you doing? He said, great, fine. I got a long list of things I'm going to accomplish. And I was like, I got one. This is going to be a good time. And he's been running around with me ever since, the poor bastard, you know? And the crazy thing is, like, every once in a while I look around and one of the guys that I sponsor is sponsoring a guy. I've got a sponsor today. You know, he's not here tonight because he's selfish. He's spending time with his girlfriend, so I guess I'm going to pass one time. But, you know, we got this crazy thing. It's a family. You know, I show up my home group way too early. I stay way too late. We don't leave until we make fun of somebody so bad they leave crying. It's like family dinner with my mom and dad all over again. But it's I love it. You know, it's absolutely my home in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's part of what made me feel connected. It's part of what made me feel useful, right? Because I got there and they gave me a job. I told my sponsor, I said, I'm terrified. They said, great, you're a breeder. You know, I remember my first night at the home group, living in this halfway house. I finally got honest about the relapse. You know, my sponsor says, Luke, you're going to have to tell him. I said, you're crazy. I'm going to be homeless. And he said, then homeless is what God wants you to be. Go back it up with action. I was like, oh, I knew I shouldn't have got the sponsor for 4 months. It's a bad idea. And I started going, I tell him, like, listen, I relapsed a couple of weeks ago. And they're like, did your crazy 4 months have the sponsor tell you to tell us that? And I said, yes. And I said, why? Don't you realize, like, you're putting us in a bad spot here? I said, well, I've only put myself in a bad spot, and if God wants me to be homeless, I'm going to be homeless. And they're impressed with that. I said, and they let me stay, right? They said there's a couple of conditions. Number one, you got to quit this job that you've had because it's where I relapsed. And number two, you got to stick with this crazy sponsor that's giving you off the wall direction. And no matter what, if you stop being sponsored by him, then you're out of here. You're on bottom line contract for the next 90 days. Do whatever he tells you to do. You know, we're working on inventory. We're working on a 4-step, and he's asking me, how's it going? I got a couple of names. How many? 7 or 12? Or, you know, I'm doing that thing where I don't want a lot, because we've been talking about giving honest answers when people ask me direct questions. It's a problem. I don't know if anybody else ever had that. I love to lie. You don't have to. It may save me from being pinned down in the truth later down the road unintentionally. But I just lie. And he's like, dude, you don't have to lie. Just tell the truth. So we're working on these small things, right? And in the course of writing this inventory, and I had to quit this job, and my closest friend in the halfway house comes home and said, Luke, they're all talking about you over at the job. And I said, what are they saying? He said, dude, they're saying you're gay. I said, that's ridiculous. Why would they say that? This is stupid. Somebody's trying to do harm to my character and my integrity. Who said it? I'll kill him, right? Because now I got a cop that said I'm a man. Nobody talks about me like that. Cut it off at the source and everything's going to be okay. And he's like, dude, why are you freaking out? And I'm like, oh, no, the direct question is coming. Right? And he asks the direct question. He's like, why are you freaking out? Dude, are you gay? He's like, yeah, man, but I'm not ready to deal with that. I'm not ready to talk about it. I'm not ready to go there. Just leave it alone, please. If you care about me as a friend of mine, I said, yeah, fine. I've been talking to my counselors, and I've been telling them what was going on in my head. I really want to write this 4-step, but I'm terrified. I got a couple of counselors telling me, leave off the bad stuff. Anything that slows you down, just take what you need and leave the rest. Write 2 inventories. Share one with one person, one with the other. That gut, that thing that still talked to me, even when I was a maniac, it's like, don't do that, you'll die. You know, usually when it was pulled into the thing I wanted to do, and I listened to the thing I want to do, but I did the thing I didn't want to do. My counselor says to me, she was the director of the house at the time, she says, Luke, why don't you just write it like you're not going to share a 5-step and then sit on it for as long as you can? You know, Jedi mind trick right there. And I said, okay. So I wrote this honest 4-step. I got it on paper. He's picking me up that night. Are you gay? Yes, I am. Don't tell anybody. I won't. I go upstairs to put my shirt and tie on for my home group. When people ask me, why do you put on a shirt and tie? I just kind of laugh at myself because I think of the night it saved my life. You know, my sponsor tells me to wear a shirt and tie. I don't question it too much. I go upstairs to get my shirt and tie. He's on the way to pick me up, and I come downstairs, and I'm in the laundry room, and they're talking about Luke, and, oh, did you hear? And that's it. I'm out. Screw you guys. I don't need any of this. And I've hit another brick wall, right? It's too painful. It's too scary. I can't get it. I'm not capable. I get in the car with my sponsor, and he says, what's going on? Nothing. I'm fine. And he cries, and he pushes, and he says, why don't you just tell me what's going on? And this kid, younger than I am, straight guy, I'm not comfortable with him. You know, I don't believe in God yet. I got on my knees and said a 3rd step to a prayer and a God I didn't believe in. I turned my will and my life over to a father that I feared and let him do his best with it with his 4 months. And that turned out all right. So, you know, but I don't believe in God. I don't have any trust in other people. I just take a blind faith leap out here to get him to turn the car around. If I freak him out bad enough, he'll turn around and he'll drop me off back at the house. And I said, Tom, I'm gay. And he said, so what? And I was pissed.
This is the last thing, right?
I've got no more Beacon stores. I've got no more Hard Luck stores. I'm holding on to this for the right moment. I just use it at the right time, and you won't turn the car around. I hate you, dude. I hate you. And he says, you're going to do something a little bit different today. You're going to go out to that home group. You're going to shake hands. You're going to welcome people. You're going to smile. You're going to be of service, and you're going to stop being so selfish and stop thinking about yourself. And wow, how dare he? You call me selfish in a moment of weakness. I've just told you something. I'm blustering and yelling and everything else. And he says, dude, you're going to show up. You're going to shake hands. You're going to make people feel welcome. You're going to be of service. You're going to stop thinking about yourself for a little while. Maybe you'll feel better. And he was right. You know, the basis of my recovery today, I learned in the first 90 days, trust God, clean house, and help others. If you try to harm me, you try to use something against me, you try to slow me down, you can't do it if I'm aligned okay with God. If there's nothing separating me from Him, people just add to the positivity. They don't take away from it. I don't have to trust you with my stuff. I trust God. That's why I sponsor guys the way I do. I tell them way too much. They walk away sometimes scratching their head like, I don't know how that helped me. Lay all on them. Full honesty, right? And the cool thing is every once in a while they give me a little bit of them. They give me a little bit of honesty. They show me a little bit of what's going on in their life, and I'm a little bit better because of it. But at this very early beginnings, this 60 days sober, I was terrified, but I was okay for that hour. Until we turned around, he brought me back to the house, and he dropped me off. He looked me in the eye. I said, you know you're going to be okay, right? And I didn't believe him, but it was a nice thing to say. I said, thanks, Tom. He said, no, you know, if you're not okay, if you think something bad's going to happen, you think anything's going to happen, you call me. You got a bunch of guys that care about you. We'll be here to pick you up. We'll get you somewhere where you feel safe. And the first time in my life, I experienced, like, somebody knew the ugly stuff, right? The stuff I was most afraid of and cared anyway. I went into that house, and I felt like an alien. They had a secret meeting about me and how they weren't going to acknowledge it. The next day, I sat down with my counselor, and for the first time, I experienced the presence of God in a way that I could feel it in my heart. I said, Kathy, I'm a victim. It's a bad hand, it's bad timing, it's bad luck. And she said, Luke, don't you realize what happened? You let go of your own will, you let go of your own stuff, just enough that God slapped it out of your hand and give you an opportunity to see what life can look like. And on the last 3.5 years, the better part of 3.5 years, I've got an opportunity to see what that looks like in my life when I keep my hands off the wheel. I don't do a perfect job. I screw it up most days. And I'm opinionated. I'm arrogant. I'm sarcastic. I'm run rampant with character defects, but it keeps me so close to God, you know, that I wouldn't have any other way. Got through the steps with my sponsor. It was like triage the first time. We moved too fast. We weren't thorough enough. I didn't know enough about the big book. You know, so I've been doing it wrong since I got here. I'll admit it. You know, but I started sponsoring God in about 90 days, and that's when my life really started to change. Things started to line up a little bit differently. There was a little bit more between me and the front door and what I thought I needed to take out of the world. And it's gotten me through like some really, really tough lows. Last summer, I had probably the lowest point of my sobriety. It's one of the worst depressions I've ever dealt with. I'm resigned to the fact that sometimes I'm going to feel broken and I'm going to feel lonely for absolutely no reason. As a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's my business to not ask questions about why I feel that way. You know, it's my business to concern myself with others and see what I can do to be of service. And when I stick to that simple principle, right, just try to help others a little bit more than I'm trying to take for myself, everything stays on an even keel. First honest relationship I ever had with another human being was my sponsor. The next honest relationship I had was with the first guy I sponsored. I sit down and listen to an inventory with. Because of that, I know what it is to be on both sides of a loving and honest relationship, right? Sitting there without judgment, sitting there not receiving judgment. Gives me a basis to go forward and to rebuild the past, you know, to have new relationships with my family and the people around me. And it's because of that I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, a drug, or a minor emotion-altering substance since November 10, 2010. I don't fight the fight. I don't hang in there. You know, I don't have to play the tape. I don't have a tape playing in my head. You know, I regret the story every time, but it's not something that's going to jump out and get me. I just trust God, I clean house, and I help others, and I try to do that every day to the best of my ability. And that's all I got. Thank you, guys.